You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. We are in the midst of an intense summer for the national news, but it's kind of slow for theater right now, but we have a lot of catching up to do. I'm here with, by the way, my name. That's how slow we are today. Rob Weiner-Kent, editor-in-chief of American Theater. I'm here with
Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
A Deep Tran, associate editor.
Right. And you might have noticed our last podcast was recorded live, excitingly live, at the TCG conference in D.C.
Only one tech issue, so... Right. Hope it wasn't too horrible of a listen for all of you out there.
I didn't know. What was the tech issue? I don't remember. You mean the sound?
Oh, no. Just like Peter's microphone cut off a little bit. So his sound level was a little bit lower for a while.
And then I had
to recalibrate accordingly. But if you did not notice, then I did my job well. Yay.
Good. And that was an exciting and interesting podcast, but what was one thing that was missing was we weren't able to talk about the conference on the podcast because it was set at the conference. It's sort of we're inside the bubble with that one. So we wanted to, since all three of us were there, just debrief a little bit about that. Then we're also going to talk about our July-August issue. The previous podcast, you'll remember, was with Lou Bellamy from Penumbra and Jonathan McRory from National Black Theater talking about August Wilson's Ground in Which I Stand, which was part of the July-August issue, but there's a lot of other things in the issue we wanted to talk about and highlight. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about abuse at theaters and equity. We'll touch on the 99C plan. Those aren't totally related, but we're going to group them together with a little bit of news chat. And then we're really excited. We have an interview with someone we met at the conference, Josette Bushell-Mingo, who directed the first Swedish production of A Raisin in the Sun with an all-black cast. So that's a fascinating interview, which we'll bring to you after we discuss things amongst ourselves. So, TCG. Allison, you were our reporter on the scene. Mm-hmm. You have written a big story about the pre-conference, which was the global gathering, which is the first couple days, and then the conference proper. What was your big takeaway from this? I mean, just tell me a little bit about your impressions of your first conference too, right?
Second conference.
Oh, second. That's right. Second, yeah. Right. Cleveland was last year, yeah.
Yes, Cleveland was last year. But writing the conference stories, I kind of was running around for the whole conference and I feel very lucky because I got to see a lot more sessions than I think a lot of TCGers got to.
Right.
The global pre-conference, I did not attend last year. So this was exciting. It was held on Georgetown's campus. There was 26 different countries represented, people from all over the globe.
Right.
And it was focused on exile and migration. So there were a lot of panel discussions about censorship of theaters across the globe, different types of topics that are taboo that are being done in shows, just different representations of culture on stage. It was fascinating. It was like a 12-hour long conference.
Wow.
Jam-packed.
Conference within a conference.
Yes. Right. And a lot of the topics that were covered at the global pre-conference really tied into TCG's overall theme for the conference this year in D.C., which was Theater Nation, which was a very broad term, but it was looking at the global theater community and how we're not really separated by borders. So it's all tied in.
Yeah. Well, I noticed because as I was writing my write-up about the last plenary session with that three-way conversation between Ambassador Samantha Power and Kwame Nkrumah of Center Stage and Public Theater's Oscar Eustace, there seems to be this, like the overarching theme of the conference seemed to be like tearing down borders.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to putting up walls. Right?
As opposed to putting up a wall and making Mexico pay for it.
Right. Wait, that sounds familiar.
And I don't know if you've noticed this too, Allison, but it was like a very politically minded conference. There's a lot of references to Orlando, which
still fairly recent.
Was very recent. And also like border conflicts and what?
Brexit.
Yeah, Brexit.
And Brexit.
Brexit happened while
the same week.
While we were at the conference, and I went on a tour with a number of Brits the day the votes was happening. And I was like, are you checking your phones? It's like, and they said they wouldn't find out till late, but the feeling was not that it was actually going to happen. And the next day I was talking to them depressed and you know, just figuring out what to do. Some of them were like, we're glad we're here right now. That's what a lot of Brits said. You know, the politics and global thinking is always part of TCG's conferences, but especially this year, it was really because of the political year we're in, because of the city was DC, and because the theme was Theater Nation, it did seem to really have it like a resonant, the themes really resonated throughout the conference. I think the only comparison I would make when we did the conference in San Diego and you did the pre-conference was in Tijuana.
Oh, yeah.
And that was about borders, right on a border. So the location always plays into it. I think Cleveland had a lot to offer as a theater city right in the heart of the country. The location is always sort of a one of the stars, right? It was a star in Boston and L.A. Next year, I'm really excited, Portland, which is a fun city. So it was I will just say it was a big, as far as I know, our biggest attendance since L.A., 1,100 people. And I didn't go to the pre-conference. I was just at the Renaissance Hotel, and I was overwhelmed. I just couldn't quite contain. I don't know what it was. I don't think I was asked to do much more than previous conferences. I always, you know, monitor a few sessions and then wander around a bit, do some interviews, and go to some parties. It really doesn't sound like that hard, but it's because it's the only only time of the year where the whole national community sort of, or at least representative, converges, comes together in one place. I had the experience repeatedly of seeing people I've known for decades, giving them a hug and then not having anything to say, like not having time to say anything to them, or
and never seeing them again.
Seeing people I've only talked to on the phone. Miriam Love, the great Oregon Shakespeare actress. When I first got to the hotel with my family, she's walking through the lobby, and I could shout like, "Hello, Miriam! I just talked to you on the phone. You know, I've seen your work. I've talked to you on the phone." That kind of thing. And then I find out. I asked someone later, like, "I wanted to say hi to her, but she's actually gone. She was only there for a little while." So
I think Allison and I had this conversation about there are so many sessions that we wanted to go to, and they were all scheduled at around the same time that we couldn't. Like, I was in the overtimes, the session about the new overtime rules in U.S. labor law on Saturday, and at the same time there was a sexual harassment session. At the same time there was a gender parity session.
Right.
I think it was that Saturday too that was the culprit. I was in the Lean In American Theater Women gathering Saturday morning, and there was some backlash because a lot of the attendees were torn between attending the there's I think three other sessions at the same time, the gender parity and the sexual assault. So there was a lot that were like-minded, that everybody wanted there to be like a track for theater women, and there was not.
I mean, you've got to give credit to our conference organizers, Devin and her team, Devin Berkshire and her team. They did a great job, and they packed so much in, and they get such great people, and it's all great to be there. It's just, again, it's an embarrassment of riches. It is too much going on. And, you know, that's why I hope we did do coverage of the plenaries online as they were happening. The American Theater staff was there, and Allison's pieces and our Twitter account. We try to report on it so that people can read about what was going on and sessions they weren't able to be part of.
And I believe HowlRound TV was there, and they live streamed some of the breakout sessions too. So you can go on
the addition to the big plenaries,
to. So the videos are also online for that.
Yeah, HowlRound has been a great partner with that. So I definitely recommend that. Some of those speeches, Anna DeVere Smith's speech was especially interesting, and we might be publishing that. So
no promises.
Yeah.
No promises right now.
So anyway, the conference is always a big, it's like a TCG Christmas and Hanukkah and the high holidays all rolled into one for us. It's too much. So it's too much, and that's a good thing. Our July-August issue is also an embarrassment of riches. We've talked before about the Ground on Which I Stand package, which I highly recommend you take a look at. August Wilson's speech we reprinted after 20 years. We have a great look back at that time, and then online a huge number of responses and reflections on that. But our special theme for the issue, for another part of it, was design and tech, which is deep, curated a lovely bunch of stories in print as well as online. Would you tell us a little bit about that section? What was your favorite part about it?
Sure. Well, I do have to blame Rob because he just came up to me and said, do this issue.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about curating, well, the great and the not great thing about curating issues is, like, you can basically go wherever your heart takes you mm-hmm. as an editor and what interests you. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's always that feeling of, I don't really know what the hell it is I'm talking about. So you're kind of hoping that the stories you curate will have some resonance with the readers. Mm-hmm. And so far, so good. I mean, there wasn't so much of an overarching theme for the stories that I curated. It was, the sense was, I wanted to do something on special effects. Mm-hmm. And so there was a story by Zach Thompson that was in print about how magicians are being incorporated as dramatists rather than just, you know, workers for hire.
Right. And not just doing tricks, but sort of sculpting whole theatrical productions,
events.
Right.
Yeah, The Tempest, you know, where Teller like incorporated curious devices that Shakespeare specified for in his script.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And I did a story also in print about how theater artists are using new and old technologies within their work.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny because I've been playing the Pokemon game recently, Pokemon Go, the app where it makes you take a walk and catch Pokemon.
It doesn't make you take a walk, Deep. You're choosing to do that.
You have to. Well, the only way you can catch Pokemon is if you go outside and take a walk.
Okay. All right.
And so, and it uses this technology called augmented reality that imposes images on top of the viewfinder on your phone.
Right.
And I realized I was playing. I was like, oh my God, I wrote about this in this article, and theater artists have been... Well, not a lot of them, but the Builders Association in particular has been playing with this technology for, mm-hmm. I think, like 3-4 years now. And so they were one of the examples I used about theater artists integrating new technology. And mm-hmm. then there was also Lightwire Theater using wearable lighting technology mm-hmm. in their costuming, and also face tracking technology with Cloud Eye Control, this company in Los Angeles. And so it's a thing that's happening, and it's not an extraneous thing just done for special effects, but it's, in terms of augmented reality, it's used to supplement the storytelling and make you feel like you're, as an audience, in the world of Oz, which was really interesting.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I think when we've written before about different, you know, quote unquote, new things like immersive theater or even projections, I often fall back on the idea that, you know, projections have been around, the idea of projection has been around ever since there was light in a theater,
exactly.
Right? And immersion has been around as long as the Bacchanalian festivals or whatever. But this technology you're talking about actually is kind of, does feel like a new thing, that they're actually taking technology, the stuff that we wear or have in our pockets, and putting it into both the audience's hands and on stage in ways that are creating new forms of storytelling.
Exactly.
Andrew Schneider is another one you mentioned, and the Manual Cinema, whose stuff is really low tech. It's like we're talking overhead projectors, but it's using projection and technology in a way that feels different in this space.
Yeah, well, you don't think like you would use overhead projectors in theater. You think about using it in a classroom, and you just like you're projecting a simple image onto a screen, but
right.
they're also making a movie with it. So
right.
it's using these things that we don't associate with being in theater and saying the things that we use in our lives could be integrated into this art form.
Right. And speaking of technology on stage, I will say that one of the very pop, those stories were both in print, and the really popular online ones.
Oh God.
I can't pronounce her name, but Amy, it's a long
last
name. I
can't pronounce it
name,
either. I'm so sorry, Amy. Amy Van Widget?
Something like that. Glisbers or something. Anyway, it's not in front of us. She wrote a wonderful piece about working with robots, actual robots, writing plays for robot performers and the sort of dramaturgy of writing with robots, and just the challenges, you know, of robots' response time, their responsiveness on stage. And
having to reprogram them because they don't
yeah.
react can't react like a human.
They're
actor.
Not real good listeners, right? Although they could be. They could be theoretically. Anyway,
you can't negotiate with a robot.
She wrote it's an interesting piece that touches on a lot. She talked to a lot of other people who are working in this field as well, not just herself, about just the issues it raises. Not so much ethical, but just about
this fear. I think.
Well, about how technology is a part of our lives. It really it's a fascinating. A piece, and it's fun, and people loved it. People love robots.
People love robots, and people also loved this piece that Ben Thorin, the technical director of
piece.
The
I
old
forgot, yeah.
Globe, he wrote for us about like how they built this rotating self-driving house for this musical called Rain that they mounted last year, and it's like the three-story house with on wheels, and then it turned, but they didn't use a turntable, and so like it's not just it's not just tech. That we're all using in our daily lives, but just like it's also things that have been on stage for 100 years, turntables and
turntables,
wheels.
Right. And, or this was like a car, basically, right?
It was
like
basically a car
driving a three-story house. Yeah, that was a fascinating story. It's a lot of stuff. We're planning to make this an annual special issue on design, which I look forward to what our next one is. We'll maybe talk again, Deep, or let someone else do it. Let someone else do it. So let's briefly touch on a few like theater controversies. I don't know how to group these together. We never spoke here about the Profiles Theater in Chicago, which was the subject of a blockbuster long form piece of investigative journalism about decades of allegations of abuse and sort of psychological manipulation and just mistreatment that was going on at the theater under the leadership of Daryl Cox and
his co-artistic director Joe Jarvis,
who seemed to be enabling
complicity.
That was less drawn out, but complicity was also seemed to go toward a lot of different people who maybe feel in retrospect they should have known or didn't do as much as they could have to help people who came forward or tried to come forward in various ways. And there's the Not in Our House movement, which we wrote a piece about without referring to specifically to the allegations because we hadn't done the investigative journalism ourselves, but someone wrote a piece about Not in Our House in the spring for us. So the Profiles Theater, it was a devastating piece, and it closed within, I would say, a week of the story coming out, and which I think, at the closure of any theater is sad news objectively, but probably not that one. Given the circumstances, I suppose it could have been reformed, but it seemed like it was an endemic problem. The good news at the end of this is that it has a new tenant already. They already have the keys, and it's I forget his name, but he used to be the artist director of Bailiwick, Chicago, and it's a gay and lesbian theater. And I think that's this new one's going to be that too. I don't think does it have a name, the new theater, or no?
I believe so. I need to look it up.
We look that up while we just briefly touch on the other news about theater controversy. That's the best way to put it. The 99-seat plan in Los Angeles, I don't know how to encapsulate it quickly, but basically Equity would like to end that plan. It's a plan by which actors in Los Angeles in theaters under 100 seats can work for next to nothing for small stipends. What's the name of the theater, Deep?
Oh, Pride Films and Plays.
Oh, Pride Films and Plays. That's right. Okay. Yeah. In any case, the 99-seat plan is a way that actors can work in a kind of a showcase code-like thing like in New York. Equity actors can basically work without benefit of a union contract and with small reimbursements or stipends at the most.
Work for, because unlike the showcase code in New York, where it has to be a limited run in Los Angeles, it could be a show that runs for a month.
Yeah. 60 performances or something. It's a long time, I believe. I don't remember the exact numbers. It does have some limitations, but they're really, really wide open. And I don't think it's been pointed out, there's not really a budget limitation. So you can have a $2 million theater and still work with a 99-seat plan as long as your theater is small enough and you work within other limitations. In any case, Equity wants to organize a certain number of theaters that are, let's just say between the 200,000 and up range. And there's been a huge pushback from folks who I know very well in the scene I knew really and covered and loved very, very much, who have built a whole sort of culture of making plays with this contract, just a huge proliferation of theater, and they want to keep doing it, and they don't want to be held back. Long story short, they filed suit, I believe, late last year, but they never served it, and they really just wanted to, with the lawsuit, to bring equity to the table to try and come up with a better plan. And I'm leaving out a lot of stories, a lot of part of the story. Like, there was a vote last year, the equity, a referendum, in which it seemed to indicate that 2/3 of the people voting did not want equity to get rid of the 99C plan. This lawsuit was sort of a last-ditch way to get equity to the table. Equity recently announced, this is the news, that they've broken off negotiations. There's no more talks. The lawsuit may go forward now. Equity's already moved to dismiss the lawsuit. They've said that the 99C plan will basically end, not be able to be used after this mid-December of this year. So, I mean, this is not the end of the battle, I don't think, but this is the, you know, the, we're getting into the final phase of what's going to happen with this push with equity. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know what's going to happen, frankly. What theaters might break rank and start to use a 99C plan that where they pay a contract, an actual contract, not a plan. And what theaters, whether they'll just hire work non-union or whether they'll fight this, whether if the lawsuit goes forward, I'm not sure what that does to the timetable of the plan. So we don't have any new fresh reporting on this, really. Just one story. I don't know what we're going to do. What we're going to say to you.
Oh, nothing. I just wanted to clarify that the alternative that Equity is proposing is minimum wage, which in Los Angeles is $15 an hour.
Right. Well, it's actually, that's one of the contracts. They also have a couple different workaround plans. They're allowing membership companies to continue with a complete waiver. And they also have a showcase. They have a version of a showcase code with under 50 seats. Which I don't know how many theaters in LA are under 50 as opposed to under 100. Anyway, so yeah, there's some exceptions, but indeed, minimum wage is just sort of the legally mandated. If you're going to have a labor, if it's going to be a contract, that's the bottom of what the union can recognize, at least from their point of view. You know, the other side says, look, this is a recognized right to volunteer, which is the language is in the 99C plan. To volunteer in theaters, to work on your art, and, you know, basically contribute to theater, subsidize theater that you want to see made with your talent. And you know, I think in general, my takeaway is that I think both sides, the more reasonable people on both sides, agree that there is sort of a fence around, there should be this, some sort of work without contract should be allowed, like in the showcase code, but that the fence around it has to be, it's just a disagreement where that line is. How many performance limit? What's the ticket price limit? Mm-hmm. What is the budget limit for the... And that's where the disagreement is. And, you know, there's some on the extreme pro-99 side who talk like there should never be any limit, which is crazy. But then there's some on the union side, I think, which are a little too, you know, that there should be... The actor should never be able to work without a contract, which, you know, there are cases where I think that it's been shown, especially in big cities like New York and LA, where it makes sense, right? So anyway...
We were talking about this before we recorded, but because going back to Profiles Theater and then this question of like, when does Equity protect its members? Mm-hmm. And I noticed when I was reading the article about it that the theater, even though it was non-union, it was hiring non-union actors until I think like 2000, a couple of years ago, 2013.
But it was non-union and it had... Some kind of a union signatory house at some point. And I'm not sure when or what kind of contract it was. So how strong the protections were.
Exactly. Right. Well, that's why our house is created in Chicago, because non-union actors aren't protected from sexual harassment. They don't have the unions who can file a lawsuit on their behalf.
Right.
But what I'm curious about, and perhaps a reader can, you know, educate me on this, what was the response from Equity if there was harassment towards Equity actors at Profiles Theater?
Mm. Well, the stuff that was described, I was saying that I need to go back to the Profiles story and see where the Equity... I don't think the reporters are really clear on... I think they called the theater a member of Equity, which is a theater that doesn't become a member of Equity. But I have to look back at it. Definitely the stuff that was described in that story would be in the purview of Equity. There would be an Equity deputy on on even a 99-seat show in L.A. has an equity deputy, right? Mm-hmm. If stuff like that was going on, I mean, my limited experience, even being a musician in a 99-seat show, there was an equity deputy, and there were meetings called when anything even – it wasn't an abusive show at all. It was just like, that's too many hours. We need to talk about whether this is – we're going to go forward or not with this rehearsal. If that stuff was going on an equity show, people must have been really looking the other way. And I'm not sure if it was the union so much as actors, you know.
Stage managers, right. Was there even a stage manager?
Well, there would have been an equity stage manager, although one of the things about the Profiles Theater that was really messed up was the fake credits, like the directors.
So I wouldn't be surprised if Daryl Cox like made up a fake name for a stage manager.
We should look back at that story and look at if there's an equity angle to it. I mean, again, the union is its members, and it relies on them to report and live up to whatever the contract is. But I can't imagine if that Killer Joe, for instance, were done under some kind of equity contract, then it would be a huge dereliction of the union reps on that show to let that stuff go on like it did. So we'll find out more.
And that is why I really wish I went to that sexual harassment session at the conference.
Were there Not in Our House people there?
Yes.
From Chicago? Okay, great. See, that's like I didn't even – there's so much going on at that. There's too much. Speaking of the too much going on at the conference, the conversation you're about to hear is with Josette Bushell Mingo about her Swedish production in Swedish of A Raisin in the Sun, Lorraine Hansberry classic. I have not edited the dialogue yet, but there were some guys moving tables behind us. So if you hear some extra noise in this, that's because we found as quiet a place as we could at the conference, but it was a very busy place. So you might hear some rumblings and creakings in the background while guys literally roll tables on the floor behind us.
It's not Deep's fault in this instance.
No. So enjoy this dialogue, and we'll be back with some recommendations at the end. So I'm here with Josette Bushell Mingo, and you are based in Sweden?
Yes.
And you staged the first production in Sweden?
Yes.
Of Raisin in the Sun?
I did.
Tell me a little bit about how the production came to be and what it meant in Sweden. And
I think what's very important is to contextualize my position. I'm a black British woman,
okay,
which means I come from a very different artistic history,
right,
and history of my African heritage. So this is the first thing. The production came about after some years of suggesting that it was now time in Sweden to do a piece of work like this. What's important as well to say is that when I've been speaking, it's not because Sweden does not have its own talent, does not have its own leadership, and does not have the possibility to do everything itself, but there are infrastructural racist constructions in Sweden that exist.
Okay.
And so the context of A Raisin in the Sun was twofold. One was to bring a seminal piece of work to an audience that had never seen it before.
Right.
The second thing was, for the first time, as I've understood it, engage an Afro-Swedish ensemble on stage to produce one of the most seminal pieces of work.
Right.
And the reaction was, I think there's more about the pre-reaction. There were skeptics, you know, saying,
sure,
well, is this going to work? And are people going to understand it? This is 2016.
Yeah.
And they're asking me these things. And because it was created by the National Touring Theatre of Sweden, which is Riksteatern, and three other co-producers, there was always the faith that it would work, because they actually put money in.
Oh, okay.
And in instances, they put money in not having any actors themselves.
Right.
There was a rich pool of black actors in Sweden, but not that many. I mean, we're about 180,000 out of 10 million.
In the population,
yes, in terms of Afro-Swedish. So the result of the actual production, I think, was both joy. I think there was shock in many instances, particularly from the white audiences,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was, as one of our great actors, David Lenneman, said, that this piece will not change racism, but it gives me an island on which to hold on to.
Hmm.
It gives me a way of holding on to myself.
Right.
what also happened in the process, of course, were very, very personal journeys. I mean, I'm sitting here speaking to you now, I think it's almost impossible to communicate.
Yeah, yeah.
Watching a room of Afro-Swedish people read a play where they no longer had to worry about what the character looked like.
Okay.
Every single word, every single gesture, every lovemaking, argument, fight for your sons was all written for them.
Yeah, okay.
So it meant that they just had to concentrate on acting.
Right.
They didn't
right.
have to concentrate on, well, this is a role that's normally played by a white person, and
yeah.
if I just play it well,
yeah,
it'll
yeah.
be done. Costumes, hair for the first time was being constructed and built for them.
Right.
It wasn't, well, this is the 1930s, how did we do black hair in the 1930s?
Okay.
It was
okay.
actually about the demand that the play had.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened was to watch, of course, the personal journeys, which is a conversation that came up in the discussion, was to watch the personal journeys, because I think that was twofold. There's the first part, which is about legacy. What happens when your history is erased? What
okay.
happens when you do not tell another person's history, which is actually the piece of the conference? What happens to you?
Right.
As a white person, you can follow your history from the beginning of time to now.
Yeah.
Because it's located from the museums to the schools, from the universities to the libraries.
Yeah.
It is very difficult in Sweden to do that.
If you're of African descent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're of African descent, you can go to the Americas, of course, but you can't find it. So the first thing that happened in that position is legacy. To
right.
watch a community of people sit in a room and understand, in many instances, that their history was incomplete.
Right.
They had always known it, but to sit and read Walter when he talks about the dream for his son.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the actor playing it, David Lenneman, he cried several times before he could do it. Mm. And it's still a resonant piece. The other part of it was, yeah, I think that was maybe the most difficult thing, because I as a director,
yeah.
could only walk alongside my actors at this point and then meet them on the other side of it.
Of
and
their
that
journey.
Of that
yeah.
journey of, I have not read these books. One or two actors have never heard of Lorraine Hansen.
Right, right.
And her whole corridor of allies, from James Baldwin to Andrew Meyer. I mean, all of these black writers, Langston Hughes, all of these writers that are in the room with Lorraine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They had understood. Yeah, I'd kind of heard about them somewhere, and I knew there was a black, but here was a piece of work
right.
that spoke to me directly and woke me up. And so an idea of coming out as being black, of standing on a platform and saying, I am black,
right,
and
right.
this is me, and I'm black.
This is amazing. It's a sound design we have going on.
Exactly. And I am a black Swede, and all the ramifications that come with that, and some of those journeys are not complete. I know they're not.
Talk to me a little bit about the journey. You say that they just, this cast, really resonated with the parts. They felt like
absolutely.
They're written for them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's it's a translation into Swedish, but
yeah.
there's some, do you feel like there was a distance that you had to travel also to encompass the American experience in this play? Or?
We played it as if it was set in America. The only thing that changed was
the language.
The language.
Okay.
This is very important. I think trying to translate it, we were trying to translate it into a Swedish setting would not have worked.
No, sure.
And distance is happening all the time when we're playing Chekhov.
Yeah, yeah.
So that distance has always been there. For countries where English is not a first language, distance is always there. It's always about translation.
Yeah, yeah.
The translation we did was by Elizabeth Grönlund.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was actually very, very good friends, very close to Lorraine Hansberry House.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
She was a complete fluke. I came across her because she heard we were going to do the production. She said, oh, well, I think this is quite interesting. And I said, well, this is interesting. And she sent me a little bit of text. There were others that had were showing an interest of translation. But the main point of it was that the translation that we did for A Raisin in the Sun was set in the United States. But
right.
the language that was used was Swedish.
So, and you felt that the... I guess there's a whole history to talk about,
mm.
and the New York Times piece talked a little bit about this, of the history of Africans in Sweden.
Yes.
And you're going to have to forgive,
if you can,
my total ignorance of the story of Africans in Sweden, if they were brought entirely voluntarily or not, or if they came...
Sweden did not have slaves arriving here in the same way as in the United States.
Right, they didn't bring in ships.
No, there are recorded blacks in Sweden from the 1500s serving
right.
in the court of the Swedish royalty.
Right.
Sweden had slave castles, and they were involved in the gold and wood
okay.
trade.
All right.
Sweden also has another kind of history, which, although it's not directly African-related, of course, is the race biology.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It is Sweden that actually formulated the structures for the definition of race.
I did
and
not
it was
know
the
that.
Swedish people who asked the Germans to make the letter J so you could decide the difference between Jews and Germans. Sweden did this.
Wow.
So the idea of race is an extremely controversial word and idea in Sweden. And
I didn't
realize. This has led to a rather strange democracy of knowledge, which is that I wouldn't call it a democracy of knowledge, an implosion of we'll airbrush everything out not go into the nitty gritty and the pain, and we'll deny a history. But the legacy of that, of course, is generations of Afro-Swedes growing up, coming into a consciousness in some peculiar ways.
Right.
Late on, traveling away from the country to find out. So I think it's. In terms of a process, in terms of the history of blacks in Sweden, there has always been the presence of African descent in Sweden.
Right.
Most of the African descent came really from places like South Africa.
Okay.
There, but in terms of whole slave communities, there are records, but it's not a massive.
Since you mentioned South Africa, was it a situation? It sounds like there's racism embedded in the
yeah.
society in some ways. But was there an apartheid system? Was there a Jim Crow kind of system that Afro-Swedes have had to deal with?
No, not in the same
way.
Jim Crow is happening now.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Because of the backlash against immigrants in Europe?
I think a Jim Crow, a kind of artistic Jim Crow is happening.
Oh, okay.
Which is rules and ideas and patronizing structures that say, well, if you're just over there on your own, then that will much better than if you try to come in with us. Or, which is one of the examples I used yesterday, I personally am sick and tired of being asked to be the curator to the museum of my own life. I'm tired of being asked, can you explain this to me?
Yeah.
I'm tired of being still. I'm tired of being emerging. I'm tired of being in training. I'm tired of being an associate. I'm tired of people saying, could you explain that for me? Or, you're too sensitive. I'm tired of it.
Right, right.
And certainly this conference has emphasized that.
Yeah.
So in terms of the movement of Afro-Swedes, what's happening now, which is thrilling, is that there are huge underground movements, several of them inspired by the civil rights and activists there, that are happening in Sweden. They're happening particularly on the digital sites.
Okay.
And some of that I've recognized from the conference, and it was articulated very well. In the different conferences that I'm in, you must now speak truth to power. There is no one can get away with it anymore.
There will
be someone in the room, probably of a diverse background, who will raise their hand and call you out.
Mm-hmm.
There is no longer the possibility that artistic directors and boards of directors can sit in these roles and be uneducated, unprepared.
Yeah.
This is not possible, and this consciousness is happening in Sweden.
Okay.
The difference is it's happening in an augmented, and by that I mean it's happening in such an intense period.
Okay.
Such an intense period. In the last 5 years, there have been changes in the Swedish consciousness for Afro-Swedes. I took 50 years in England, 100 years of slavery in America.
Right.
And sometimes it's very painful.
Huh.
It's like, you know, it's very, very painful. It's like giving birth in 6 hours, you know. But that doesn't mean that the struggle is not going to be complete. It doesn't mean that pain doesn't cost something.
Yeah.
Or that pain is not going to produce a result. Sweden will change. There is no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
The question is the rest of Sweden prepared to change with it?
Yeah.
And A Raisin in the Sun brought a mirror up directly, not only to the lives and stories of African Americans, but of course it reverberated to the Ethiopian communities that are living here, the Syrian communities that are living in Sweden, Bosnian communities that live. I mean, it resonated with everybody.
The different immigrants in there, yeah.
Yes, we were sold out, 48 performances from the top to the bottom.
Now, I think you're aware of Clybourne Park, the play that sort of, even before that play came out and put the focus on how the neighborhood changed and gentrification, I feel like that would be when I read Raising the Sun and watched it, it's about the African-American experience, but at a certain pivot point in which they were claiming integration and that. I mean, there's certainly characters in there who don't think integration is the be-all, end-all, and that owning a piece of property should not be the definition of manhood or of. And yet, it's a play in a way, I feel, about real estate and about property and about manhood and womanhood. But I think it's because Walter's the center of it, even though Lorraine
Absolutely. I think the construction that Lorraine puts together, which is one of the reasons it remains a great classic, really, yeah. is the way she juxtaposes both the female, the black female, and the black male yeah. in opposition. She also has a feminist and patriarchal perspective on things, because yeah. if you look at it through a gaze from today,
yeah.
particularly in the first two acts, you'd say, what kind of character is this Walter? I mean, he's yeah. cynical, yeah. sexist, etc., and comes into his own. But as a guy, who's the character, the Pan-African character,
yeah. Yeah.
this is the one that, as I've understood, held many of Lorraine's personal beliefs.
Right,
but
right.
But actually, at the end, is it about soul and spirit, and that is unbreakable.
Yes.
It is unbreakable. I heard a very great motivational speaker say, out of over 150 years of slavery, and you're telling me that we can't get through university? He was speaking to a lot of young people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the most dangerous and exciting battleground is one that is against the spirit and the psychology. The property is a symbol.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
It's a symbol
sure.
of something. Having money is a symbol. It doesn't mean we don't want it. It doesn't mean we don't have a right to it.
Right.
But way and above that is spirit. It's got to be. Otherwise, we won't last.
Right, right.
I think there are other tensions. I think the Pan-African perspective for me has grown more and more. We've got, in a theatre world in Sweden, we're talking about safe rooms, rooms where only those of African diaspora meet and speak. Again, both digitally and physically. And those rooms give articulation. They give a chance to be angry together. They give a chance for intergenerational
information,
support.
Yeah, support. Yeah, okay.
We're also able to support each other in situations which already have been happening in the Swedish theatre. And the difference is that 10 years ago, for example, nothing would have happened necessarily. There might have been a bit of bobbling. But, for example, there was a picture that was produced by the opera in Sweden.
Uh-huh.
And on it was a beautiful black dancer. And he had a white foot pressed into his neck, which was actually the gesture of a white choreographer.
Okay.
I know the choreographer well. Everybody knows who it is.
Yeah.
But, of course, once that picture is blown up, what you have is a black man with a white foot pressed up against his face.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of art, you go, well, yeah, beautiful picture. But in terms of issues of race and diversity, it was not acceptable.
Right.
I say it was not. Did nobody think about this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The difference this time is that the whole cultural community responded to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially those in the Afro-Swedish.
Okay.
So Lorraine's play reflects back that there is now a time beyond the house, beyond the ownership of things, but actually to the spirit.
Okay.
And that actually, if there's one thing you can do, is put your hand up or step forward and go, this is wrong.
Right, right.
And this is the huge shift that I feel in the Congress here today and also in Sweden, that people are saying, I don't have anything to lose.
Right, right.
This can no longer go on. And as you may be aware, we've had quite an extraordinary couple of years in Sweden in terms of quite overtly racist action.
Yes.
Whether it's cultural ministers cutting cakes or
Tintini
Congo and discussing whether or not the black characters are racist or not, even though they've got black face with big
yes.
white rubber lips.
Yes.
We're talking still discussing about Negro Ball, which basically means Negro Ball, which is the name of a chocolate, which is black and is covered in coconut. I mean,
we've got versions of that too. I mean,
the difference is that it's being spoken about.
This, I think, is
crucial. So I think in terms of the impact of the play, in terms of Lorraine, in terms of the politic, she is teaching us to call it out now. There is no question on God, Earth, why new plays, as well as Lorraine's plays, can be done on Swedish stages.
Right.
End of story.
Right.
That has changed, and I was part of it. It's changed forever. It's done.
So you had said there are not a lot of Afro-Swedish actors.
Mm-hmm.
So was it putting the cast together a bit of a challenge or no?
When I say not a lot, I mean when you're going into the theatres, you've got maybe two or three
right.
that are employed out of ensembles of five or six.
Yeah,
you know?
And they have state theatres where people are on basically repertory companies.
Yeah, we have
acting
different
companies.
Yeah, we have everything from projects
to
live contracts.
Okay,
well. So I will go back on my statement. I'm just going to analyze it a little bit more.
Yeah.
When the first thing was that once the play was agreed, was that I was going to audition.
Okay.
There were two roles that I knew I wanted, and that was Walter and Lena.
Right.
But every other role was auditioned. And the reason that it was those two was that they embodied a very particular spirit for me of the piece.
Uh-huh.
And we had, I think, around about 47 applications. Now, you might think if this was in the United States, there would be 147,000.
Yeah, right.
For us, this was great.
Yeah. Well, that,
it was great.
That's
it
a lot
was,
to choose
and
from.
It also wasn't unexpected either. And they came from all walks of life. So was it difficult to audition? No, it wasn't really. It wasn't difficult to audition. It wasn't difficult to say...
To find the people. Yeah,
and
right.
then to find the right people. It was just about choosing the right people at the time. I think one of the things that did come up out of this, though, was I was contacted by, you know, more than five now, or six people that auditioned and said, one, I know I didn't get the part, but can I just be around? Can I do something? Can I assist? Because I know this will never happen again, this atmosphere.
Right.
And more importantly, are you running workshops, Joseph? Is there any way that we could continue this process? Not just about interview feedback, but actually about having black bodies in the space, working on texts that are about us, developing my craft as a black Swedish actor. And so this was quite a revelation to me, because again, I'm from the United Kingdom, so my upbringing is, you know, I'm one of a thousand. There's a thousand Gisettes out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But here was something else. And also my own responsibility, the artistic sector's responsibility in this. Theatre, drama schools are producing more African descent and a word we call, or artists from other backgrounds. In Sweden, the word is rasifierad, which is those who are judged by the race that they come from. So this is also a word that's there. Which
that's
is,
like we say person of color?
It's a person of color.
But the phrase refers to artists judged by race? Or
yeah, it's what happens when someone walks into the room. They go, you must be from the Middle East.
Okay, as opposed to... Okay.
Yeah, so this is a word that's come up and is very needed, because every country deals with these issues in a different way.
Okay, okay.
But I think... No, I don't think. I know. The personal stories and the public stories was... This is what I've been waiting for.
Yeah.
It played to a predominantly white audience across Sweden.
Right.
Sold out, standing ovation every night.
Right.
Till the very end. And a kind of relief, affirmation, a little bit of panic, I think, from the theatres, because it was now being a production that was referred to. People were quoting it on radio, and they were, we've just done Raising the... You know, all of this was beginning to happen. And I think there's an unease... A little bit in terms of the theatre, how they follow it. Not because ours was a defining production,
right.
a defining moment.
But it does change things.
Yeah, completely. There was no longer any for bullshit. You can't have the plays.
Yeah, there's no talent.
There are the actors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't have the money. You have the money. So that for me, the central thing is, why are you not doing this?
Right, right.
You really strip it away. Let's get right down to the nitty gritty. Imagine we're outside the boardroom. What is it that's said in that room?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something again that was very interesting was... today in the conference was, you know, money and racism go hand in hand.
Sure.
In the sense that, look at how much money is placed for the idea of changing racism, for creating more diversity.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a clear signal as to where it's prioritized.
Yeah, someone said budget is a moral document.
There you go.
I mean, and I feel like whether it's intentional or just an oversight or the effect is the same.
Thank you.
You know?
Thank you.
And in fact, it's even come up that sometimes, although no one welcomes open racists, at least open racists, you know where they stand.
You call me nigger to my face.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know that's a word that I use in context.
Sure.
However, this is going to be, because you call to my face and I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But this subtle, what I call perfume, that you can smell something in you, but I don't, this is the worst. People looking you straight in the eye.
Yeah.
Straight in the eye. And being silent, you know, supporting things through silence, saying nothing.
Yeah.
Our white colleagues saying nothing in the room when you've heard it. You heard it said. And particularly in Sweden where, you know, I haven't heard the word bloody democracy used so often as I've heard it in Sweden. Democracy this and then women's equality that and children this, etc.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
When it comes into the absolute, when it comes to race, people back away all the time.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Time. I think sometimes we Americans idealize Europe as being so enlightened and ahead. And, you know, we certainly can't point to Europe and go, oh, there's so much more racist, because we have a huge problem, as you know. But when we look at, in particular, I know when the issue of blackface comes up, I talked to a director, Stein Vinga, who runs the Norwegian theater. And, you know, we talked about the Othello he did with Bill Pullman playing Othello. Now, that was a whole conception where he reconceived it as a different setting, right? But when he's telling me his favorite Othello was, I forget his name, Peter, a German actor, and I went online to look for that, and it's... Yeah, with this kind of fuzzy... It was terrible.
And people justify that shit all the time. I just don't...
Well, German company was going to do Clybourne Park. Do you remember this story?
Yeah,
they were going to black it up for Clybourne Park, and luckily the author said, no, that's not going to work, you know? Yeah.
So
anyway,
I think these are important insights into some of the infrastructural racism that still exists.
Yeah,
we
are
in arts institutions with state money often, and you are sitting opposite people who have been paid to do this.
Yeah.
Who say, I don't understand why you are getting so upset.
Yeah, yeah.
What is wrong with using that word? And the worst call of all is, are you oppressing my artistic freedom?
Yeah, sure.
And my
sure.
question is, yes, I am.
Your freedom to do that.
Your freedom to do this, I question.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
Yeah, yeah.
That just really sends me off the balcony. How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you even enter the room with this?
Right, right.
And I'm talking about boards, I'm talking about artistic directors.
Yeah.
It looks good, it sounds good, you filled out your paper, and you will still go back and repeat the same shit again.
Yeah.
You will keep doing it. And also because race is something, this is where I'm in my head trying to analyze, when we're talking issues of LGBTQ, when we're talking about, for example, I also run the National Deaf Theatre of Sweden as well, so I'm working in a sign language environment a lot of the time, who are zero represented in any of these discussions.
Yeah.
Persons who have or consider themselves or society to have a disability, rarely. It's just not. Persons of Asian background who are also having seminars.
Yeah.
But all of these peripherals, the things that will change, make the absolute dynamic in life and thrust of art completely pushed to one side.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you just produce a white monolith. Is that not boring? And an image I keep using, if you keep doing that, if you keep just playing and reflecting back, you know what happens to reflections in the mirror? It just disappears.
Yeah.
It implodes on itself to nothing.
Yes,
nothing. And that is what will happen.
Yeah.
That is what will happen. The other thing, of course, which you discover in places like this is that actually we can do it ourselves. We do not have to wait for the institutions anymore. We will call you out, and once we've called you out, we will move on.
And produce your own work?
Find
your own funding?
Find your own companies?
Yeah, yeah.
Find other strategies and find other allies.
Right.
Because there are allies.
Now, is that what you're doing next? I'm sure everyone's always asking, what are you doing next?
Oh.
What are you doing with the momentum created by Raisin in the Sun?
Lots of things. One of the first things I'm going to do is to bring the ensemble here.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and I've been speaking with various theatres here, particularly the Swedish embassies, to bring the ensemble here, to meet their African-American counterparts, and then to bring an African contingency. And an African contingency would be choosing one or two of the countries, and also Black Britons, together in one room.
Because just for a conference, not for a performance, but just to meet each other.
I'm hoping a performance will come
at some point.
Them.
Okay.
That's the next big thing for me.
So to create original work,
create original work and to see what happens when we meet each other, because we are meeting each other via somebody else's story.
Yes.
Somebody's telling it for us, and so I think the next big momentum for me is now to bring those people together. The Arena Theatre.
Okay.
That I've met.
Yeah.
Are doing A Raisin in the Sun.
Oh,
so I met the staff there, including Molly and Robert.
Yeah.
The idea is to bring my ensemble to meet them. It'll be amazing to watch the African-American Walter meet his Swedish counterpart.
Yeah.
And to do the same speech.
I want
to
hear that.
Sit and listen to it and go, is that what it sounds like? For the artists themselves, we won't be able to afford it this time, but that's the next big thing.
Okay.
After that, my instinct, my stomach instinct, is to start a black theatre company in Sweden. Because of what it will do to change a history. And I'm prepared to risk everything to do that. That's my next thought.
Fascinating. This is maybe a side topic, but I wanted to ask you, does Swedish theater, maybe European theater in general, do what we do here with what we call colorblind or non-traditional casting, where you have a cast of different ethnicities performing a classic or...
Well, we don't do it enough. The two things that happened, colorblind casting was a discussion adopted mostly from the United Kingdom. I think that's where it first came to the Arts Council. And then it became very, very clear that there is no such thing as colorblind casting.
No, it can't be colorblind, right?
No, you have to be able to see. It's also kind of...
color-conscious casting.
Yeah, a little bit like that.
Yeah. Really
blind? I mean, where are we going?
Yeah, exactly. No, the term is not good for...
So, but absolutely. Has there been... has there been enough cross-casting in that way?
Mm-hmm.
Mostly through gender.
Okay.
You know, so King Lear is a woman.
Right.
She's a white woman, but she's a woman. So yeah. Gender issue, of course. But they haven't had a black Queen Christina in that sense at the Royal Dramatic Theatre, or
yeah.
You know, half of the family in Fanny and Alexander,
yeah.
Or from Syria. No, we're not there yet.
I will say, I don't want to slag the Brits, but I do feel
do
that, I, especially right now, right? After the Brexit. But, yeah, no, you can say whatever you want. It does seem to me the RSC brought their, the recent, they called it King and Country. It was Richard II and the Henry IV, Part 1 and 2. Anyway, it was Anthony Sher and David Tennant. And I noticed that there were some actors of African descent in there, and they were playing very small roles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were young, so maybe you can say, oh, they're not seized, you know, they're, mm-hmm. they're working their way up through the spear carrier roles as every other young actor mm-hmm. does. But I don't know. I think there's a tendency, Charles III, which is on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess it would be too much of a leap, because that's sort of realistic. It's supposed to be Charles and Diana, Camilla, mm-hmm. and those wouldn't be non-traditional. But there's a black actor in that who plays, you know, bartenders, and like I again, the version of inclusion that happens in plays is often not.
And what you're feeling
the leads
is like,
or the.
No, it's this. I mean, because also as well, there's a kind of visualness
yeah,
that happens.
Yeah.
You can see him, but he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the challenges that we have is that for me, we're still the only community of people defined by race, by color.
Yeah.
Say Chinese. And say African, but often it's black.
That's true.
It's the only one, and it's so deeply embedded.
Yeah.
So I think the sophistication and complication of cross-casting is something that's an absolute red herring.
Right.
It's an absolute red herring. More black actors, more diverse actors in main roles on stage, and if they're not there, you create the training, and then you clip them the
yeah.
roles. That's it. There is no other way to
Well, that's why I think they've added the word equity.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's diversity inclusion. It's but just including people
yeah.
and without giving
enough.
Them any stakes or role
exactly.
or power.
It's
yeah.
the same thing. We have increased the amount of diverse actors coming to theatre school. Coming out, are the plays there? No.
Yeah, right.
So we've got this kind of catch-22. So it's, I'm sitting in the University of Diversity at the moment, but in all these countries, you know, you have to sit there sometimes and I think, what are you going to do with this all, Gisette? I feel I'm at a sort of intersectional tipping point.
Right.
There's so much of it. Now in the autumn, however, my tipping point has come because I will be doing my own show, actually.
Okay.
About Nina Simone, about my relationship with Nina Simone, because this, what we're talking about now, this kind of meeting place, these plates that are meeting, I don't know what to do with it.
No way! You got to tell me about that, though. Is it a play you perform?
It's a piece
you perform?
Of work that I'm going to start rehearsing in the autumn. And if you like, it's a response to a situation that I can't control. The tipping point for me was Sandra Bland, young woman. And this, mm-hmm. I don't know why. Something with, partly because people said I look like her, which is not true, I think. But,
right.
Mm-hmm. The incidents that have been happening, of course, in Sweden with the cake, etc., the extraordinary brutality of blacks within the United States, and the continued mental, if you like, enslavement, but fight that's still happening with my black British counterparts. It's happening as I speak.
Right.
You know, Brexit will not help. It will not help.
No.
I mean, that's a whole other interview, but what have we done?
Yeah.
I get this horrible feeling we're going to get up tomorrow and go, what was that? Did we really?
Yeah.
This is my instinct. This is my feeling, is that I think it was about a million that made the difference.
Yeah.
Those young people are going to live with that for the rest of their lives. I mean, anyway. Tipping points when it comes to the Nina Simone piece is me, where I am now, saying, can the audience help me navigate this? Can you stop me from doing something stupid?
Okay.
Can you help me as an audience? Nina helped me. Her songs help me, so I will be singing her songs.
So you'll be Nina in the show, essentially, or
no? I will be singing Nina's songs. No one can be Nina but Nina.
No,
I will not
no.
make that mistake. But it's called Nina and Me, and it's a story about how I navigate these three plates.
Right.
Because for me, it's dangerous. It's dangerous as an artist. It's dangerous as a black woman. It's dangerous as a human being.
Right.
And when I see all of these things around, you just sort of sit in the middle as an artist and go, what do I do with this?
You followed. Must have followed the controversy about the Zoe Saldana casting, and It's just a bad story. No, it's just a bad story all around for everyone.
What happened?
Yeah.
I mean, how did it? Well, I know how it went down here.
Yeah, yeah.
In the States, and I stopped reading it. Really, I think I stopped reading it when she started to speak.
Yes,
she started to defend herself. And
right.
And I understood it. I understood why she did it. But this one that's why I'm not going to play Nina. I'm not playing Nina.
Okay.
I'm going to be Josette, a version of Josette who uses Nina to guide her through certain things.
Okay.
But I'm not playing Nina.
Yeah.
I mean, what they did to her face. I mean, they put on a false nose, and they put in false eyes, and they put in false
hair. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, the hair was like the minstrel show.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Forget that there were all the African-American women. Who could have played that role?
Oh, no, there's whole galleries online of people who could have played the role. There's so many people, yeah.
And I completely understand. And then some of that I found quite painful was when they then described on Facebook all of the team around her, and they were all white, more or less, the makeup artist, the director, the producer. Well, there wasn't a black person around her, she would probably do it again. She would probably justify it again, but I think that was a move that wasn't right at this time, girl. One day. One, it's like, can a white person be Martin Luther King? No, not yet. Not yet.
Not in my lifetime, I don't think.
No, you know it.
Right?
No, absolutely. So I think, so that piece really is a response. It's a response to Lorraine. It's a response to a promise that was made that one day we would be free, you know?
And I
see it, I understand it, but when I'm looking around in these three landscapes, what I see is hope and triumph. What I see is huge struggle, huge rage. What I see is people taking guns up and blowing people's heads off.
Right.
That's what I see happening. And so my metaphorical gun, because I'm a coward.
Yeah.
I'm not going to take a gun to anyone.
You're going to sing a song.
Maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. No, of course I'm not going to take a gun. But I mean, trying to explore that artistically. What do I do?
What do you do with rage?
What do I do with all of this now?
Yeah.
What am I going to do? So I think maybe in the end, the only place you can turn to in the end is yourself. It took most of my spirit to get the Raising the Sun up.
Yeah.
Because if I'm speaking truth to power, my theatre was not that enthusiastic at the beginning.
Okay.
It took a long time to come into the system. When, as far as I'm concerned, it should have been, we say yes faster to other things than this one.
Yeah.
Once it was in the system, it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary process all the way to the end.
Just thank you for your time, Gisette. I wanted to, in closing, I want to just hear what's the title in Swedish? I gotta hear that.
Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Endruven I solen.
You're not even gonna try and say that.
Endruven, which is a raisin. A druven is a name for a grape. And druven I in solen sun.
Endruven I solen.
There.
I did it. Thanks for your time, Gisette.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Such a pleasure.
And we're back. We'll just quickly give a few recommendations, things we've seen that we want to talk about. Allison, you just got back from the Contemporary American Theater Festival in
Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
Tell us about it.
So I saw 5 new plays in the last 3 days.
That's a lot.
It was
of plays.
A lot.
Yeah.
So I'm still mulling through some of the plays in my head. One that really stuck out to me was Chisa Hutchinson's The Wedding Gift. It was a world premiere play. Just the whole production of it, the set design was incredible, and the costumes were very elaborate. It was a set in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Chisa's stage direction, as I was told in the opening of the play, was takes place in the so far in the future, it's stupid. So that's how it's set up. And the play is about this other world, this culture. She made up an entire language, so it's made up. So you don't understand what's happening on stage. You just kind of have to figure out through body language. And, you know, it felt like watching an opera. So there's one character that's given to this newlywed couple as a gift, and he speaks English. So he's stuck in this world where he can't communicate, and he's basically a pet. It's just kind of fascinating because you're watching it and you're like, what is going on? But things unravel and you learn why he's there and how he's there. But it was just really crazy. And talking to Chisa, she wrote it In undergrad, it was an assignment that was like, write an unproducible play, and this was it. And her classmates said, this will never work. Like, no one will watch a full length of this made up language. So it was kind of cool to sit and watch this thing that she created and she was able to do. So
that's amazing. That just sounds great. So Deep, what do you have?
Well, I think it's really overdue because it came out like around conference time. I think everyone's read it by now. But if you haven't read Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce's Oral History of Angels in America on Slate.com, you probably should. Otherwise, you are not being a good theater person. The great thing is, theaters aren't known for keeping really good records of their history.
Right.
Well, theater in general. And so it's so great to have this, like, first person, well, so many multiple persons' account of this really seminal American play and how it was created. Like, I didn't know that it was first mounted in a small theater in San Francisco because in all the records it said Center Theater Group had the world premiere production.
Yeah, there's a lot of legal stuff around that, yeah. But it was commissioned by Eureka, right?
It was commissioned by Eureka, and it was developed at Eureka, and it shut down the theater because it cost them a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, like, all this wonderful detail about how Tony Kushner wrote Perestroika while in a cabin that was filled with bugs.
You know, I mean, yeah, what came through in that piece really strongly was just how painful the gestation was.
Yes,
everyone there, and everyone was still very raw. I mean, everyone was glad they did it, but boy, the producer Rocco Landisman saying, you know, we would have actually broken even if we hadn't done Perestroika, but still, it's the best thing we ever did. Like, I'm glad we did it. So,
yeah, and how the original draft of Perestroika was 700 pages.
Yeah. No, it's a great yarn. Sort of like hearing that story, even if you don't know the play that well, you should. But it's a great yarn telling the, and then getting to Broadway with the George C. Wolfe section, and then the aftermath,
and then the little tension between Tony and Oscar, because Oscar co-directed the world premiere, but then when it came to Broadway, George C. Wolfe directed
it.
It's like so much drama that you forget about because, like, when. As a journalist in American theater, people don't like saying ugly things about their collaborators.
No, but even at the time, I knew, had friends who worked at the Taper, and something went down with Oscar and Tony Ciccone and Tony Kushner that just, like, I think it had to do with just making the choice to go with a different director for Broadway, but it was a painful time. And Oscar and Tony are still, Oscar, that's Kushner, are still, like, best friends, but, you know, their friendship survived despite this. It's one of the huge rifts, and it's like Miller and Kazan. It's like this huge rift that between them. It's not for the same reasons and not as rancorous, but just like, and that's the kind of, it's, you know, what it's so satisfying to me in a month where we published this piece about August Wilson, looking back at the legacy of that, and then looking at the legacy of Angel in America. You know, we were living in great times. Like, the theater lore that we're living in, the lore of a certain show that's on Broadway right now. It's like, these are, we're lucky to be alive right now. How lucky we are to be alive right now.
Well,
right?
And they made a lot of comparison towards the end about between Angels of America and Hamilton, and how it was a Hamilton of the 90s because it went outside the scope of just this industry. Like,
right.
It showed that theater could be like a vibrant force for social change and dialogue.
Right. And it was talked about places like, other than the theater pages,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And it had, you know, arguably had impact on that final speech about We Will Be Citizens, you know, it had an impact on the way gay characters and gay stories were told. And you know, and like, I think the piece made this point that it put gay men at the center of the American narrative.
Yes.
To work out not just issues about AIDS and gay life, but about America and what it means and the world. I get emotional talking about it. It's a great piece. I think that should be my recommendation too, but I will just close by recommending the big package of interviews we did around the August Wilson thing. I was really proud and privileged to interview his widow, Costanza Romero, who's just a mensch. If a woman could be a mensch, she's a mensch. She's just a wonderful person. And it was a great interview. And then the other one that just came to us from a scholar named Nathaniel Nesmith, he interviewed Charles Johnson, the great black author of Middle Passage, who lives in Seattle, and befriended August Wilson when he moved there in the 90s. And they had these long late night talks at a diner about their lives, and that's just a fascinating interview. This package was not meant to be a retrospective about August Wilson per se. It was supposed to be about his speech and what he was saying, and actually Charles Johnson has a lot to say about that. He differs with August Wilson in some of his politics and sees race as a social construct and not as an essential part of one's nature, which is a huge fault line in that the speech exposes. And I can't recommend that interview highly enough. All the interviews I think are great. Of course, the package is wonderful, but Charles Johnson one turned out really well. You know, the thread that ties all these together, Isaac Butler, who did the Angels in America, who wrote the big August Wilson piece for us. On that note,
he is the alpha and the omega of theater right now.
He's the secret weapon. All right. Well, on that note, we will close with another exciting week. Like us on Facebook, write a review on iTunes. Links to all the things we talked about will be on the show page. Is that all the business we need to talk about?
Yeah. Have a good week, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.